Thank you for downloading this podcast from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. This Pardes Live and Miniseries podcast features Rabbi Dr. Daniel Gordis, who spoke on We Stand Divided, his newest book about the rift between American Jews and Israel. For more digital content, please visit elmod.pardes.org.
Jews have always been divided. They were divided in biblical times. You mentioned the two kingdoms, Hasidim and Mitnagdim. U.S. Jewry today is divided. Israeli Jewry is divided today. So is this division any different? Or is it just continuity with the rest of Jewish history?
All right, that's a really great question, obviously. It's an excellent question. So you could make that argument, right? You could make the argument that we're just going to go do our own thing. I think that would be a different kind of a division than we had in the past. In other words, first of all, we know that when the North and the South divided, they not only were unable to defend themselves against the outside, they actually periodically fought each other, and we know what happened. You had Galut Bavel. I mean, if you think that, but I'm saying, if one thinks that that's an acceptable result, then yeah, we're fine being divided. That didn't work out. Now, Hasidim and Mitnagdim, when you're really, really angry at each other, that's actually better than not caring, right? That's why I would prefer a huge blow-up fight about something as opposed to a young organization that says it just doesn't take a stand, right? Just couldn't care less. Not opposed, by the way. Just not in favor, like, whatever. Whatever. Whatever is a disaster, right? When you're having an argument with somebody that you care about and one person says whatever, that's the end of any constructive conversation. Because it's not whatever. You're having an argument because it's not whatever. Because somebody cares about something. And this, you know, whatever, we don't take a stand, it feels to me, is a new thing. The other thing, of course, is that Jewish peoplehood was always undergirded by a sense of loyalty to Torah. And a deep familiarity with at the very minimum with Torah. And until the modern period, by an allegiance to the dictates of Torah. And that, of course, is a very different world in American Jewish life. That's a different conversation than the conversation we're having today. I wrote a piece in the Jewish Review of Books about this issue, I don't know, a month ago or whatever. It's easily findable. You can just Google it, Jewish Review of Books, whatever. But I think that there is a danger of a different kind of a rift because we don't share the same wellsprings of Jewish identity. And I think the world's getting dark again, and the clouds are coming again, and we need to be united and fight this together again. And in that regard, I think the most apt example that you gave was the North and the South. When they couldn't actually not fight with each other, they also were completely unable to protect themselves against the outside. And I think we need a sense of cohesion in order to get together and figure out what are we going to do about a world which is radically different than the world that it was 5 years ago. 5 years ago, you couldn't name a shooting in a synagogue. 5 years ago, you didn't know who Jeremy Corbyn was. 5 years ago, a lot of things were very, 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 very different. So this is, it seems to me, the time to figure out how to come together.
Okay, we'll take some questions. Mark?
My question is, who are we talking about? Just with the whole conference today, the whole conference on the same issue today. And my question is, there is such an interrelated population now. There are hundreds of thousands of Israelis who are Americans. There are tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of American Jews who have family here, second home here, half Aliyah, not. Then you have millions of American Jews who are way off, assimilated.
Okay, I gotcha.
So who are we talking about? What is the influence?
I think we're talking about thought leaders and their followers. That's what I think we're talking about. I mean, obviously, let's take America. You're right. There's people on both sides. It's all mixed up. And I thought you were going to say that there's lots of American Jews who, you know, our definitions of Jewishness and their definitions of Jewishness might not be the same. So who are you talking about in that regard? I think that's all legitimate. And it's a very important point. And the Q communities are intermixed. That's sure true. But there is fundamentally an American Jewish community, and there is fundamentally an Israeli community. And those communities are very divided in their outlook. So if you look at rabbinic leadership, right? I mean, really. I mean, go to rabbinical schools today in America. It's an interesting little tour. It's an interesting little tour. You know, yesterday or 2 days ago was the anniversary of Nachshon Waksman's death. I think 25 years ago, was it? Yeah. So I was in the car the other day, listening to the radio, driving along, and it brought back this memory that I had not thought about this in probably 20 years. When Nachshon Waksman, Zichrono Livracha, was killed, I was the dean of a rabbinical school on the West Coast. And I didn't know what to do. I just didn't know what to do. So we got everybody together in the Midrash, and I taught some shayur about, I don't remember what. No idea. And we walked out, this is gigantic outside the Beit Midrash, and we're standing on the porch. And a woman who was a rabbinical student then, very smart, comes up to me and she says, what does anything have happened to him have to do with us? And I remember that my only instinct was really to cry. And I then, you know, make aliyah. But, which was not because of me, it's because my wife informed me we were making aliyah. But, but seriously, like, I didn't even know what to say to her. But I think back then that was an unusual position. And a rabbinical school that will go unnamed until a number of years ago had an alternate minyan on Yom HaAtzmaut for those people who didn't want to say Hallel. Forget bracha without a bracha, Shem and Malchut, forget all that. And I say to myself, really? There's nothing here? There's nothing here that's happened in the last 70 years with all of its problematics that was worthy of saying Hallel? And we said Hallel this morning. With all due respect to Mar Cheshvan, I mean, yeah, it's a great month because you get to actually work a full week. But really, I mean, seriously, like really, I mean, really? There's nothing out here that, and I remember, like, I find those kinds of things heartbreaking. So I'm talking to the people who are at the helms of these organizations, rabbis, of all different denominations, of, believe it or not, of all different ages. I was at a meeting of Federation professionals, kind of a fly on the wall, not that long ago, a couple months ago in America, where there was a consensus. If anything in the world is going to get them fired, it's going to be something that they say about Israel. What rabbis are afraid of talking about is Israel, right? A rabbi gets up in a conservative shul and says, I've figured it out. Nothing happened at Sinai. Okay. All right. We don't even have it anymore. What do I care, right? And if a rabbi gets up and says, I've decided the Palestinians are not a people, it's over. It's over. You can pack on Shabbos. That's a psak, right? No, I mean, you can, it's over. In other words, this has become such a light. So I'm talking about thought leaders and their followers. There are obviously, you can't say American Jews any more than you say Israelis. What do Israelis think about? Well, right, exactly. And what do American Jews think about? But I think that there are trends in thought. And that I think, that's by the way, that's been one of the interesting legitimate critiques of the book, I think, by the way. So when I point to all these various thought leaders who were, you know, who were furious about Eichmann and so on and so forth, people say, but I was there then, and we were deeply satisfied also. So these people at the helms of all these organizations, you know, Proskauer and this and that, yeah, they were saying all of that, but we didn't. So you kind of misrepresented. I think that's a fair critique. It wasn't a conscious representation, but I think it's a fair critique. But what I would say in response is that these ideas that get put out there eventually get raglaim. They eventually get traction. So I'm talking about the people who are doing the thought leading work and the leading of the community's work. And that's where I see on both sides of kind of an intolerance and a callousness about the other that I think has to change. But it's an excellent, excellent question.
Okay. Yes, please.
Thank you so much for investing us. I was curious, speaking of, you said the role of these thought-leading organizations, I think it's most, as you kind of alluded to, it does seem like these kind of dinosaur organizations like the AJCs or the AJCs, APAC, and the Free Space Movement thing, are somewhat out of touch with where many young Jews are. Not saying that they have any purpose, not if not now, but somehow there is a differentiation. Do you see a role for these dinosaurs organizations? How do you see them leading this up in the future to reconnect American Israeli Jews, or do you think that they're out of the picture?
Okay, so the question is, what do I think about, I'm going to repeat the question, what do I think about these dinosaur organizations like AJC you mentioned, and APAC you mentioned, and a couple of others, J Street is newer, that seem to be out of touch with the young. Okay, so when you get to be my age, you will have learned the hard way. You never call anything a dinosaur organization publicly, no matter what you think. So first, okay. And I know you said dinosaur totally non-judgmentally. They were great, glorious creatures. All right. You know, Rachmanis on them. It didn't work out. All right, now. First of all, I think you want to talk about dinosaur organizations in Israel? Right? How many of those pre-state organizations that served as government in waiting employ thousands and thousands and thousands of people here and spend most of their time trying to come up with mission statements? So let's just make understand that it's not an American Jewish phenomenon. Organizations live on because they employ people and they have loyalty people. So this is not a Jewish issue, by the way. It's not. I mean, why are there still really, why are there Boy Scouts and still Girl Scouts? Right? I mean, seriously. There's all kinds of organizations like that. So that's the first thing I would say. The second thing I would say is I think that there is a way in which these organizations, first of all, to give them credit, are really trying very hard to reimagine themselves. They're putting a tremendous amount of effort and money into trying to re-envision themselves, which I give them great credit for. And I also think that millennials are not organization people. So these organizations could be the hottest thing since, you know, ever. Millennials are not going to join these organizations. And so it's really not the fault of the organizations. Now, it's the Jewish community is really grappling with, right? The Jewish community is grappling with, what do you do with the fact that there's a lot of deeply committed Jewish kids who don't want to sit in a big davening with a, please turn to page 243, and therefore they're deeply committed, they're Belgrade, this camp, that camp, but whatever city they are, there really is only quote of the classic synagogue thing. And therefore just like they're not gonna go to shul in Yom Kippur. They're not gonna eat necessarily, they may or may not daven on their own, but they're just not, the organizational thing isn't working, right? What are you gonna do when a lot of shuls are live streaming their services, and so you can either be a member or not a member and sit at home, so you have no incentive to pay dues and support the organization, and you have no incentive to put your tuchus in the shul. So this is a whole new world that everybody's really trying to reinvent. I mean, we know that conservative and reform synagogues are merging all over the country. There are obviously extraordinary success stories, but statistically, they are merging all over the place because the younger generation just doesn't join. So I think that some of these organizations were a little bit late getting to the plate and trying to figure out how to do this. I think they are really trying, and I think a lot of it's just a mismatch between a generation that doesn't want organizations and organizations that just are organizations. The only other thing that, well, I'll just stop with that. So I think that we have to figure this out. But I would also, here's one thing I would say. Look, I mean, I think that we have to be very, very careful. I would say this to the generation that you represent, let's say more than I do, okay? Gotta be very careful before you dump these organizations. I'm not saying that you're saying, I'm just saying that one, not you, but one needs to be very careful. Because we can say something like, you know, 2 years ago, everybody was saying, who needs the ADL? Right, who needs it? Bichlal, I mean, come on. And then all of a sudden, we need the ADL. Because there's only one organization in America that knows how to fight hate. Right? Who needs Hayas? There are no immigration Jews, I mean, not a lot anymore. Right, but all of a sudden, if you're a Jew and you want to fight the immigration battle on the other side, Jews providing, you need Hayas. All of a sudden, which has found a new way of life. People like to do direct giving instead of giving to the Federation because the Federation has an X percent overhead and yada, yada, yada. That's all good because all the sexy things are going to get funded. But who's going to actually fund elderly Jews locked in their apartments getting a hot meal every few days? There's nothing sexy about that. And those groups don't have enough money to do all the web advertising and stuff. So you need a central organization that can deliberate and decide how to distribute these funds. So I'm afraid a little, and the same thing, by the way, you know, New Hillel is taking on Old Hillel and this is all the campus stuff. True. But at the end of the day, I mean, Birthright obviously is under tremendous attack because it doesn't do enough of this and does too much of that and the other thing. But at the end of the day, what other organization in the world is positioned to bring hundreds and hundreds of thousands of young people to Israel, and then a huge percentage of them get them turned on, forget Israel, to being Jewish in a way that they weren't before. So again, one can be critical of organizations, and I work in an organization. I know that we work really, really, really hard to try to make it as great as it can, and I wasn't born yesterday. A lot of the students are wondering, oh, this class isn't so good, that, but I understand, and we're trying to get better, but so I think that we ought to also give these organizations a little bit of the benefit of the doubt, but I think it's become largely a millennial issue that is going to have to be figured out.
Yeah.
Wait, do you see anti-Semitism becoming more mainstream in America? And are American Jews sleeping less well at night?
Okay, so that's a great question. So the question was, because I know the future, and I have my little crystal ball here, thanks to Steve Jobs. You know, Siri, what is going to, whatever. So does everybody else hate iOS 13 as much as I do? But in any event, it's horrifying. But in any event, it's really one of the most horrible things. No, exactly not. But it's the worst operating system, whatever. No, I'm just kidding about the best thing. So I don't know. Here's what I will say. Obviously, nobody knows. I have a very bad feeling about where this is headed. And I'll give you two reasons, okay? One reason that I have a bad feeling is because it's very hard to think of a society that got angry where the wells of goodwill and tolerance had run empty and the wells of hate and spite and vindictiveness were overflowing that did not come for the Jews. That doesn't mean you have to build gas chambers in Kansas. It can just mean that it's going to become increasingly uncomfortable to be a Jew on campus, which it's already getting. It just means that it's not going to be so unusual for there to be swastikas on dorms, which there are more and more and more. It happened again this week at Smith College, 8 swastikas on some buildings. Smith College, the bastion of liberalism. Okay? Well, that's what they say. All right. So you don't have to have, you know, horrified trains and long lines of people and, God forbid, death. It can get very nasty before that. It can get to a world in which it was like when my father graduated college, which was you did not go to a law firm in New York City wearing a kippah and saying, here's my resume, and I'd like a job, and by the way, my people has 763 holidays a year, and I need to leave at 10 a.m. on Fridays, but I'm a really good lawyer, right? I mean, nowadays you can walk into a hedge fund, and you can walk into a law firm, or whatever, wearing a kippah, you can have your tzitzis out, and you're going to get a fair shake. That could end very, very quickly. That could end. So I'm nervous, first of all, because I think that any time a society becomes spiteful and hate-filled and angry, the center disappears. By the way, if you want to say anything about what's going on here politically, let's understand one thing. What bubbled up here was the center. Right, Benny Gantz may or may not ever be prime minister of the state of Israel. That we don't know. But the center bubbled up. And a race between whatever you think of them, Donald Trump and Elizabeth Warren, is not about the center. It's not. And every country and every society needs a center. So, number one, when societies become like that, we always end up in the crosshairs. Number two, I ask you to ask yourselves this. Give me an example of a society in which anti-Semitism started to bubble up and then it bubbled down. Very few. Not never. Happened in America. There were periods of anti-Semitism where it bubbled down. But, you know, you pour the Coke into the glass and you realize you poured too much. Most of the time it pours over, right? I'm nervous. Now, it's interesting. Are American Jews sleeping less well? So I think so. I think so, and I'll give you the following two indications. Number one, there was a poll that just came out. I forget who put it out, but this week, 9 out of 10 American Jews is worried about anti-Semitism. That would not have been the number 5 years ago. So I think that they're saying at least that they're more worried. But I'll give you the best example. I spent Sukkot in the Hamptons, right? Because where else would you go for Sukkot if you live in Jerusalem, right? So I spent Sukkot in the Hamptons, and I didn't go to the main shul. I went to the breakaway shul because that's, you know, I'm too open-minded, as my grandfather said. In this breakaway shul that doesn't have a sign, that's in a house, that's in the middle of nowhere, it's near the beach, and everybody's like Zen, 2 armed guards. Really? That's where we're at. An unmarked building, which is not really a synagogue, because they'd all be in jail if it was announced to be a synagogue, because it's a violation of the zoning laws, whatever. Big guys, packing heat. Yeah, they're worried. Should they be more worried? Should they be less worried? I don't know. But I find it tragic that we're having this conversation. Because 20 years ago, those of us in this room are old enough to remember 20 years ago, this conversation was like out of Netherland. There were lots of problems in America, but this was not one of them. So I think it's a tragic place to be.
You mentioned
we should call on some women, too. Hmm? We should call on some women. Yeah.
You mentioned that Israel is supposed to be a state place for Jewish people, which is very much kind of Herzl's vision for the state, that Jews can come and be safe.
Also, Jabotinsky. Yeah, okay.
Yeah. wondering if you could speak towards that as kind of a new model or other models of other thinkers that might be applicable and helpful.
Well, Achad Ha'am would be thrilled that you think he's new. You know, I don't know what you know about Achad Ha'am, but I never met the guy. And I love the fact that Achad Ha'am Street and Herzl Street in Tel Aviv intersect. Like, for eternity, the two guys that couldn't stand each other are locked in an embrace forever. But Achad Ha'am, apparently, when he moved to Tel Aviv, he asked the municipality to pass a law that when a certain number of blocks of his house, children could not play outside. Okay. You know, Achad Ha'am. Right, just your, you know, one of the guys. But no playing near my neighborhood. In any event, look, here's, I mean, it's obviously a great question. It's obviously a huge conversation, which we could do a course one day. It would be fun. But I'll say one thing very quickly. Let's just say hypothetically, we'll give Achad Ha'am, you know, he represents non-statehood, because he was definitely not a statist. He was definitely opposed to statehood. And, you know, spiritual center, and, you know, and Herzl, who was statist, but who really kind of didn't have a tremendous amount of sophistication about what the substance of that state would be. Here's the irony. Achad Ha'am and Herzl both got their wish. Right? They both. They're both very happy up there about everything except that intersection. Okay? No, they're both very happy. Herzl got his state. And when you go to Stametsky, or you look in here, or you listen to the conversations happening in this Beit Midrash, or you go to Hebrew University, or you go to Shalem, or you go to Harman, whatever, this place is exploding with Jewish creativity and Jewish substance and Jewish depth that Herzl didn't begin to understand anything about, and that Achad Ha'am did. When Achad Ha'am became non-religious, he wrote about this in his diary, he had a repetitive nightmare, a literal nightmare, that his father punished him by not letting him look at his books. You don't need to be Sigmund Freud, right? And that's, but Achad Ha'am would also love what's going on here. So the first thing is they both won. And here's the other thing. Had either one of them not won, the other one wouldn't have won. By that I mean, Achad Ha'am could, you know this neighborhood. There was not going to be a spiritual revival of the Jewish people in the land of Israel without a state. It was going to be the old yeshuv once again. A bunch of poor people with no access to very much, living lives of whatever, but not what we have here. The exposure to America and to Europe and to great ideas of the West and the East and mixing it in with Jew. I mean, do you know what's going on within a kilometer of this building every Friday night? No, seriously. I mean, the amount of stuff going on here, but if this was not a Jewish state, how many of the people that go to those things would actually be here? Okay, so Achad Ha'am would not have gotten his dream if Herzl hadn't gotten his. But if Herzl had gotten his dream without Achad Ha'am getting his, we'd be a democracy probably, with a lot of Jews, and probably in conflict, and farvus. Achad Ha'am gives Herzl's dream meaning, and Herzl gives Achad Ha'am's dream possibility. So, yes, they are very different dreams. There's, by the way, a huge debate now. Was Herzl really a statist? This is a new thing that's coming up. You know, what did he mean by der Judenstaaten? Okay, fine. But, I mean, it's all, that's how academics make their living. But, you know, everything that you always thought, wrong, my book. But in any event. But I think it's an interesting question. And Noam Pianko has, he's in the University of Washington at Seattle, if I'm not mistaken. Really interesting guy. He has a book called The Roads Not Taken. And he basically looks at all of these various Zionist thinkers that we didn't go with, the Brit Shalom people and so on and so forth. And I don't think he's advocating that we now do that, but we should be aware that in this explosion of ideas, explosion in the best sense of the word, there are lots of ideas that didn't, at the end of the day, carry weight. A really interesting book to look at also is the collected letters between Hannah Arendt and... No... The scholar of Gershom Shalom. Thank you very much. That's why we have. Right, between the letters of Hannah Arendt and Gershom Shalom, where they really talk about the universal versus the this, and she had all sorts of ideas about Brit Shalom, and he talks about why he abandoned Brit Shalom at the end of the day. But yeah, there were a lot of ideas that didn't make it. I think, just like in the Gemara, we studied the views of those that the halacha doesn't follow. I think it would actually be great for Zionist discourse to read carefully the views of those people whose visions did not in the end become reality. But I think it's also, the last sentence about this, it's also really important, it would be a fun exercise to ask ourselves, where's the ghost of Aleph Dalet Gordon here? And it's everywhere. It's everywhere. All those Israeli kids who tell you, and I sit now with every single We used to call them freshmen. Now, they're called first years. In case you didn't notice, this is just in. They're called first years. In any event, I sit with each and every single one today. I sat with eight of them. That's a lot, because you give each one 45 minutes. It takes up a big part of your day. But the number of them who said what I did last time and the day before is I worked in this katif, or I worked in that katif, or I worked at Shomer HaChadash, or my father has a farm, or my mother works in an agricultural thing. The way in which these kids who are cities, they're not city slickers, you know, they're like the real city people. The way in which Aleph Dalet Gordon and the love of the land is here is actually amazing. HaRav Kook is here in ways that we can't even begin to describe. I mean, he's all over the place. Herzl is here. Jabotinsky is obviously here in terms of any kind of social net in Israel. Is a Jabotinsky idea, not a Ben-Gurion idea. Right? It was revisionist Zionism that talked about the five mems, malbush, marpe, you know, law, I mean, food, roof, medical, education, whatever. That's a Jabotinsky idea. You know, Nordau, who talked about, you know, Musseljuden, the Jews shouldn't be weak anymore. Nordau's here. In other words, it's actually both interesting to have your question, which whose views did we not get, and whose do we think didn't become mainstream, but their ghosts hover everywhere, which makes this part of the extraordinarily complex but also wondrous experience that it is.
Two questions.
There you go.
Okay. First question, as an educator, what would you take from the Israeli Jewish education and implement it into the American Jewish education, and vice versa?
And the second question, I'll repeat the questions, don't worry.
Yeah. So I'm getting mixed signals because they're talking about starting this conversation and we should recognize how vibrant and dynamic the American Jewish culture is, but on the other hand, no great diaspora has lasted forever. So how do we approach this conversation? If on one hand we want to really understand them and appreciate what they are, but then also, you know, what they pack their bags.
Okay, great questions, really great questions. So the first one, what would I take from Israeli education and bring to America? What would I take from American education and bring to America? Okay, the first thing I take from Israeli education is Hebrew. How about that? It's an abomination that American Jews don't speak Hebrew. By the way, forget American Jews don't speak Hebrew. It's an abomination that the one thing you don't learn in Hebrew school is Hebrew. Okay, so call it something else, please. It's also an abomination, and this is more serious, that you can go to a very, very fine Jewish day school from K to 12 and have your parents spend, you know, I don't know, $60,000+ post-tax dollars a year and come to Jerusalem for that gap year and not be able to have a conversation in Hebrew. I mean, that's not only not an exaggeration, it's really ridiculous. But we understand that language is infinitely more than a way of ordering something at a restaurant, right? Because especially today when, you know, tall means small. And, you know, I mean, seriously, I mean, I don't even speak Starbucks. You know, actually, once this is just an aside, when we've been living in Israel for a bunch of years, and I took one of my kids to New York for my nephew's bris, and we go across the street from my brother's apartment in New York City to order some Starbucks. It was really big into Frappuccinos back in the day. And I say something to the woman standing behind the counter, and she looks at me like, she doesn't have any idea what the hell I'm talking about. So Avi says to me, Abba, Abba, Abba. I said, Avi, I'm talking to the woman. I'm trying to order something. So I explain to her what we want. She's looking at me. And Avi says, Abba, Abba, Abba. So finally says, Abba, you're speaking Hebrew. Okay, so turns out that it's Starbucks on the Upper West Side. They don't speak a lot of Hebrew, but okay. But in any event, so I allowed him to interrupt me then. But language is the canvas on which the painting is painted. Or language is the paints. I mean, language is just, right, there's things that you can't say in any other language. Right? What's the specific English word for parents who have lost a child? There is none. But there is a Bible word for it. Shakal, shakul. Mishpachot shakulot is not sad families. It's families who have lost a child. Because the Tanakh understood that there is a grief unlike any other grief. Shelo neda. And a language needs to reflect that that's not sad. That's different. Okay? In English, we say, I fell in love with her. Right? I saw her across a crowded room, as the song said. And before you knew it, you know, weak-kneed and trying to get her email address and yada, 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 out of control. In Hebrew, we say, hitahavti ba. Which, for those of you that suffered through Hebrew school, know that binyanim, that's hitpael, which means literally, therefore, I came to love myself because of her. I mean something different. It means something different. It's a different conception of love. The fact that Hebrew doesn't really have different words for like and love makes it very hard to tell your student you really like them. Seriously, it really does, you know? And then some woman is in my office today telling me that she met some guy, another student, who are chaver sheli. She goes, no, yadid sheli. Okay, because the words, languages say a lot of things. And so not speaking Hebrew means that everything Jewish is through a foggy lens. So first thing I would take is Hebrew. Second thing I would take is a sense of obligation to give time from your life to something that's bigger than you. Like that. Right? Because not only when I went to Columbia was I not in the Army and did I actually not know anybody in the American Army, it had never occurred to me in a million years that I would join the Army. So when I finished my BA, I did an MA. Because I'm Jewish. Right? And when I finished my MA, I did another MA because I'm Jewish. And then I did a PhD because I'm Jewish. Finally, I had a wife who said, you better earn a living. So I stopped all that. But seriously, when was the time that I said to myself, when am I going to do something that's not for me? Never. And every single one of our kids, by virtue of being brought up here, did that for a lot of years. And when my son got out of the Army at the age of 27 or whatever it was, after 8 years in the Army, that was a very big piece of his life, and it changed who he is as a human being. And the others, too, who just did normal service, et cetera, et cetera. So I would take Hebrew, I'd take sense of obligation, et cetera. There's a lot of other things, but I'll give you just those two. And the other one I take in the other direction is a sense of tolerance. And a sense of how you speak about people that you disagree with. That's not so true in America anymore, but it'll hopefully come back. And it used to be true. There were certain ways in which you comported yourself. There were just certain ways in which you spoke about people, whether you agree with them or not. And you talked about them, and you tried to put them in the best possible light, even if you completely disagree with their experience. And I would take that and bring that to Israel. So that was the first question. The second question was about, so if the diasporas are all going to disappear, then what's the point of trying to learn to see the world that way? Well, okay, but I mean, Poland disappeared after 600 years. So, I mean, there's a lot of understanding that you can accomplish in 600 years. But if you take your point to its natural conclusion, I think it's a great point. It's a good, you know, it's not a she'ela, it's a kushia, which is good, right? But it's, you could say, well, if I'm saying that no sovereign entity in this land of Israel lasted more than 70 or 80 years and no great diaspora, so why don't we all just go home, turn on Netflix, and yeah, mashiach, and whatever. But the Jews have never done that. And that's to our advantage, right? That's why we celebrate freedom by telling the story of what it's like not to have freedom. Because we understand that all these brachot that we have are fragile. That doesn't mean that we can continue them always, but it does mean, by the way, that thank God, by the time, horrifyingly, Poland was gone, the nascent communities here and more advanced than America were already there. Babylonia, you know, failed, but there were other places that Jews had already gone to, and then the Jews that went away started all over again. I think that saying it's all going to end, so who cares, is exactly the opposite of what Jews have always done. We have a sense of obligation to the future. So that would be my answer. You mean the divide internally to Israel? Yes, yeah, so how do we address the divide internally to Israel? Oh, that's easy. No. Look, I think, well, that's obviously a whole other conversation, right? And the truth of the matter is, who the hell knows? But let's be, there's much more here that binds us than divides us. Leaving out the extremes make for great press and for great sound bites on the news, whether it's CNN, Fox, or Israeli news. The extremes make for great little whatever. But the vast majority of people are not in the extremes. The vast majority of people here want a country which is profoundly Jewish. What's that? I only read Haaretz on days that I don't have time to work out, because my blood pressure gets just as high anyway. So if I can't go on the treadmill, I read Haaretz for 5 minutes and my pulse is, my watch is going crazy. You know, it's all good. No, but seriously, you read Haaretz. But the people that run Haaretz want this to be a Jewish country. They do. They want it to be a democracy. They want it to be moral. Haaretz has stuff about Jewish content and the Parsha all the time. In other words, you do the Chidon and Haaretz over the weekend. There's tons of Jewish stuff in there as well. In other words, I think it's too easy and too cavalier, even though I share your worry and I share your critique, especially of Haaretz periodically. Also, just getting their little Misironim on my phone is enough to periodically, you know, work out even when I don't intend to work out. But I think that it's really, really... Also, by the way, what's our Haaretz's circulation? Like the number of people in this room. Not exaggerating by a huge amount. It's a very, 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 very small circulation that speaks to a very, very small group of people, even though it's excellent journalism. I mean, it's by far the highest quality journalism of all the Israeli papers in terms of style of writing and the depth of investigation, all that. It's all whatever. But let's talk, leave Haaretz out of the picture for a second. Let's just go all over the place. By the way, one of the great things about this country, which is changing, is that the radically, we'll make this the last thing, because it'll be a good way to end. The radical anti-religious secularism of the early European Zionists is gone. That doesn't mean that there are not Israeli secularists, but it means that it's gone. Because, first of all, those people, the descendants of Hacharaam and Nordau and Jabotinsky and Berdichevsky and all those people, they are a minority in Israel. Mizrahim are the majority of Jews in Israel. The people from North Africa and the Levant, you know, Iraq, Yemen, Iran, et cetera, et cetera, they are the majority, and it's a growing majority. And they are not all frum by any stretch of the imagination, but they overwhelmingly have deep reverence for the tradition. So in this Beit Midrash, right, there are very Ashkenazi conversations that happen, which say, do I accept Kabbalat O Malchut Shamayim? Right? So if I do, A, I should go to shul on Friday night, and B, I should not go to the beach on Saturday morning. Because, as they say. Either sign I did or sign I didn't. Either God did or God. I mean, we all know that story, right? In the Mizrahi world, there's nothing in the world peculiar about going to shul Friday night and going to the beach on Shabbos morning. You go to the shul on Friday night because that's what Jews do. And you go to the beach on Saturday morning because that's what I like to do. And the homes are largely kosher, even if they don't necessarily daven. There's a kind of a reverence for tradition for tradition's sake, which is actually a huge relief to the hyper-intellectualization of the European philosophical world that has created tremendous creativity in a lot of ways and also been the root out of serious Jewish commitment for lots of people as well. I think the return of the Mizrahim to the center of Israeli culture, political life, literary life, et cetera, it's been hugely important. And so I would say that, you know, the overwhelming number of Jews in this country want it to be a moral country, want it to be a Jewish country, want there to be Jewish content in the public school curriculum. They don't want it to be Judenrein curriculum. They believe that Hebrew is critically important. They understand that you really can't understand David Grossman if you don't know Tanakh references, and they think that that's okay, because that's in part what Hebrew literature should be. And I could go on and on and on and on. Nobody objects to the siren going off in Yerushalayim Erev Shabbat because the shofar was blown in the southwest corner of the Beit HaMikdash. Nobody objects to that. The issue of buses between the cities, that's a legitimate issue to have a conversation about. Nobody drives in this country on Yom Kippur, even though it's not a law. And the best way to make sure people did drive on Yom Kippur would be to make it a law. No, seriously. Because the minute you forced it on somebody, then they would want to rebel against it. But there's no law. You can drive legally on Yom Kippur, but nobody would do it. You can't get a non-Jewish cab driver on Yom Kippur. I tried to for a non-Jewish person once, set it up before Yom Kippur. He says, "You out of your mind? I'm not driving on Yom Kippur here." Like, it just doesn't happen. And I think that there's all kinds of things. I think the fact that, you know, what's his name? Shmuel Rosner's book, Yadut Israelit, which just came out in English. I guess it's called Israeli Judaism or something like that. I don't know what it's called, but that's what it's called. It's a great book. It's a really phenomenal book. It's a very quick read. But he points out that Israel, there's a kind of new Judaism coming to the fore here. For example, is standing at attention on Yom HaShoah, is that a religious act or is that a national act? We've blurred the lines because you're not mourning Israelis. You're mourning Jews. And you could be from North Africa, which the Holocaust didn't touch your community. So when you get out of your car, when you stand at its side, what you're saying is, I'm part of that thing. That's a national claim, but it's a religious claim. There's all sorts of stuff that's happening here that I think is really fascinating. And I think the blurring of the lines between religious and national, the blurring of the lines between Masoret and Halakha, I think there's a lot more here that we actually agree on. But I think what would happen, here's what I think we can do to create greater understanding is to do what I try to do in the book on a totally different issue. How can I look at every single other person's view and put it in its best possible light? If I'm a secular Jew, what's the best argument I can make for the Haredi position? And I can make you a good case. I don't personally agree with it, but I can make you a good case. And if I was a Haredi person or a very right-wing person living in, you know, Beit Vagan or wherever, right, what would be the argument that I would make for the Shomer HaTzair Kibbutzim or for the new kinds of religious stuff that's popping up all over this neighborhood on Arve Shabbat? I can make a case. I think if we did that, if we just each said that we're going to stick to our guns about what we want, halachically, religiously, legally, culturally, but at the same time, we're going to make our conversation about this country a conversation which we take the people that we most disagree with and put them in the best possible light, we could completely change the dynamic here. And here's the last sentence. No, seriously. Do you understand what a phenomenon Shtisel is? No, seriously. Seriously, right? I mean, it did not become a popular show because the Haredim are watching television. I mean, they actually are, but it did not become, it's because, you understand this would not have been possible 20 years ago. But why is Shtisel what Shtisel is? Because there's all these guys driving Lexuses, and women, men and women, driving Lexuses in Tel Aviv, and then going home to Tzfon Tel Aviv at the end of the day from their big, tall, steel, metal and glass building, hedge funds, startups, this and that, it's all good. And they get home, v'chaser mashu. And they love their three kids. And they don't want 14 kids. And they don't want to live in poverty. But they look at those people who have 14 kids and live in poverty, and they're happy. Or they seem happy. And they want to know, what do they have that I don't have? That's an interesting question. And when an entire country gets fixated on a sensitive, kind of loving show about Haredim, something's opening up. And literally, when I was in a meeting at Tel Aviv, so it doesn't matter what it was of, but these guys with tattoos and, you know, the whole piercings and Shelo Neda, right? And we were having this, and we were talking about whatever, Shtisel, and then an hour later, we're talking about something, somebody says, Chasdei Hashem. And I'm looking at the guy, and I said, Hashem cannot be happy about this. I mean, look at you. But I didn't say that, obviously. Something's breaking. Something's giving. I think we're more curious about each other. I think we're all searching for meaning. And I think we're... same thing, by the way, with the Haredim and the planes in that episode in Shtisel about Yom HaAtzma'ut, where everybody runs to look at the planes. Right? We all do that. Every single one of us. I'm going to tell you a secret. That F-35 thing... it's not a big deal. I can see it. How great is this the stealth fighter? I can see it. It can't be that stealth. Okay, that's right. But I remember, I'm driving along in Yom HaAtzma'ut and I hear it and I literally, put my head out the window or pull the car over. Why, by the way, just to go back to history, because those planes are never again. Are never again. I mean, planes are cool anyway, but those planes are never again. And the Haredim want to look at the planes too. Not only because they're cool machines, because they understand that that's a different kind of Judaism. They're curious about the rest of the country. The country's curious about them. We disagree about lots of things. But if American Jews and Israelis could look at each other in the most possible light, and different kinds of Israelis, apropos your question, could look at each other in the possible light. I mean, this is not a new idea. Hayeh dam kol adam l'chav zchut. Make the best possible argument for her position or his position that you possibly can. We'll bring Mashiach. That's what we'll do. Have a good night.
Yeah. Well done.
Thank you so much.
You're getting better.
This was a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more podcasts, please visit elmod.pardes.org/podcasts. To learn about sponsorship opportunities, please contact Jamie at pardes.org.